Good morning, everybody. This is Dr. Joe Brickner, and welcome to my Building with Brick podcast. It's a podcast based on a book that I wrote called So You Want to Be a Coach. And for those who are new to the podcast, So You Want to Be a Coach was a book that I wrote about my going from being a corporate executive and on my 50th birthday retiring early to become the head basketball coach at Benedictine College. The book itself is available on Amazon.com. And it spawned this podcast. And what I do on most of my podcasts are in-depth interviews with very successful coaches. And my plan is not only to interview athletic coaches, but those in business who are coaches as well, and even ministers. I think they have a great calling in coaching us for being able to make it to the next stage, you might say. So today I'd like to move a little bit in a different direction. And it's just this one podcast for now, but I want to talk about the Final Four. And I've been watching, as most of you probably have, I've been watching the great games on TV. It's just a great time of year. I wasn't able to watch all the first rounders, but the last few I have been able to. And it's just exciting to see kids excel. It's fun. And they also, it's fun to see that KU, Kentucky, North Carolina, Duke, you know, all the blue bloods aren't in the tournament. And it's refreshing. You know, it's just refreshing to see new programs, new coaches being successful, and kids getting some exposure that normally don't. You know, all year long, we were hearing about the Big Ten, the Big Ten, the Big Ten, and the Big 12, and even the ACC, but they're not here. Baylor made it and should have. They've been a tremendous team all year long. But I'd like to get into a little bit of a coaching analysis of the Final Four, and I'll base most of it on the games that happened in the Elite Eight. And I want to start with the Houston, Oregon State game. That was just two tough teams, you know, and the way Oregon State came back, what a credit to them, down 17 at half. And Houston is just playing great defense, absolutely great defense. But I think one of the problems that Houston is going to run into in the next game or two is the fact that they only have two scorers, and both are perimeter scorers. The game itself with Oregon State, they were up big at halftime, and then Oregon State threw that 1-3-1 zone at them, and Houston didn't know how to respond. Now, that was interesting because the game before that, Houston did a great job of taking care of Syracuse and their zone. They got the best zone in the country, I think. But it's a different type of zone. It's a 2-3 and a lot of different principles. Anytime you go to the corner, they trap it. So you got to stay out of the corners. And they're so long out front. And it's actually, sometimes it looks like a 3-2 because of the shifts that they make. It's very difficult to beat that zone unless you go inside to the free throw line. And that's where the hole is. And that's what Houston did. And they were effective at it. You got to put somebody there that's, number one, a good shooter from the free throw line. Number two, a good passer from the free throw line. Good vision and has patience. You put somebody like that in the middle and you can beat that zone. And they did. But against Oregon State, that 1-3-1, it was kind of amazing to watch it. Because if you notice, they had four guys quite often above the free throw line. They had a 7-footer in the middle, so that took away that middle pass. And he was above the free throw line quite often. So, you know, you think about it. Well, what's that leave open? Well, both corners are open, and one man on the baseline can't cover both corners. So you can go to the corner, not have to worry about being trapped. And at the same time, you're going to get an open shot, especially if you attack it with two people on the baseline, one being a great screener, the other being a great shooter. And I had to put Grimes in on the baseline with one of their bigger guys who could set picks, and then rotate and have three guys at the top and just rotate the basketball. And as you do that, set a baseline pick on the defender that is down low, set a pick on him, have Grimes come off that pick off the baseline to the opposite corner, rotate the ball over there, fire it to Grimes in the corner. Not, he's money. I mean, you give him shots from the corner and he's going to hit probably 60%. And I don't think they would have had the trouble with the zone that they did had they run something like that. Now, Kelvin Sampson's not stupid. The problem that I think they ran into is they probably haven't practiced against a 1-3-1 zone and weren't anticipating it. Whereas they had some time to look to see what they wanted to do against Syracuse zone, and they knew it was coming. So it's kind of a surprise thing. It got Oregon State back in the game. But to the credit of Houston, they were able to do what was necessary to win that basketball game. They do have a special player, Jarreau. He's, you know, he's not extremely skilled shooting the basketball. In fact, I'd let him shoot outside shots all day long, but the boy can play. I mean, he is all over the court, and his defense is outstanding. He made a block on a shot one time, and I thought, how did he get up on that and smack it? And it was just a great block on the baseline on a kid that was shooting I think it was a fadeaway on the baseline. It was just a tremendous block. But, I mean, he just makes things happen. And when he's not on the court, it's a problem for Houston. The Baylor-Arkansas game, again, was just a dogfight. What it showed to me was that Baylor, you know, they have three special guards, and their end guys, inside guys, aren't bad. They're okay. But Mitchell, their point guard, he's the MVP of that team. Now, he didn't get the MVP of the Big 12. His teammate Jared Butler did. And Butler is a scorer, but Mitchell makes it happen. He can penetrate. He can shoot. He can guard. He makes them move a little better. And without him in the game, they really struggled. And whereas I think they could do well if Butler wasn't in the game, because they got a kid coming off the bench that let me check and see what his name was. Flagler. He can take the place of Butler as far as some scoring. And then they've got that Mayer kid, about 6'9", white kid that can really handle the basketball, shoots it, and he is not shy. I mean, that boy can shoot. He's not afraid to shoot. It probably keeps him on the bench a little more than if he was a little bit more selective, but he's explosive. And, you know, they're eight deep. In that game against Arkansas, once Mitch got back on the court in the second half after being in foul trouble in the first half, they were good. They were really good. Now, you know, I did notice one thing about them, though, that I really think they need to look at their film and correct. And that is, they don't move like they did on the offensive end early in the year. You know, early in the year, they were moving, passing. They were a lot like a Gonzaga type team in that you had to guard all five guys, and it was hard to guard them because they were moving all the time. But I noticed in the last couple of games I've been watching, they do a lot of dribbling, just and not going anywhere. Just dribble, or set that high pick with the big guy and try and come off that and try and penetrate a little bit, and then throw a little pocket pass or something like that. And, you know, that's okay sometimes, but you got to be moving on offense. And they had four guys standing around, or at least three guys standing around with the big guy coming up and setting the high pick. And that offense has been around for a number of years now, and people know how to guard it. Personally, if I was going against that, which I did in the last few years that I was coaching at Benedictine, we trapped it. We trapped it because it's usually a smaller guy coming off, a big guy, and you put a good solid trap on him. He's not going to be able to dump the ball down to the guy on a pick and roll because you're just big. And if he does and he throws it to that guy that's rolling, number one, he's a big guy. Can he handle the basketball? Number one, can he catch it? Number two, can he make a good decision once he catches it? Can he put it on the floor and take that one dribble he's going to need to get to the rim? Or can he just pull up and shoot it? You know, and most bigs can't. There are some can, but most can't. So trapping it out there, I think, is the way to go. I think what the difference was between Baylor and Arkansas was Baylor's bench and then Mitchell being able to play the whole second half. Now, the Houston-Baylor game, I think that's going to be a just knockdown drag out because both can guard and they can really guard. I don't think it's going to be a very high scoring game, but you just never know if they can start turning each other over. There's going to be some transition baskets, and both are good in transition and scoring. My opinion is that I think Baylor's going to end up winning that mostly because they have better offensive players. Houston has to depend on two kids to score, Grimes and Sasser, and they don't have much else. And if you can keep them contained, you can beat them. They're tough, physically tough, mentally tough, and they'll battle and battle and battle. But the ball still has to go in the hole. And I think that's where Baylor has an advantage in that they've got quite a few people can put the ball in the hole. And if they're shooting the ball well that day and moving, they got to move. If they don't move, they're easy to guard. I mean, you yourself know if you've played. The toughest guy to guard is that guy. It's always on the move. You don't know where the next pick's coming from. You don't know if he's going to backdoor you. So trying to guard somebody on the move is much more difficult than somebody that's just standing waiting for a penetration pitch. So I think Baylor's going to win it. I think it's going to be close, but I think they're shooting, and I think they're a better free throw shooting team also than Houston. I think that's going to make a difference. Now, Jarrell on defense is going to shut down somebody, but he can't guard all three guards, you know, Teague, Butler, and Mitchell. He's got to guard probably Butler. He'll shut him down. He won't score much, but they've got so many other weapons that Jarrell can't guard them all. And then the other thing I think Baylor needs to do is wear Jarrell down. Now, he works so hard. He's just everywhere on the court. And last game, he was bringing the ball up on offense. I'd pick him up full court, and I'd turn him two, three times in the backcourt, just work him. And so that when he does get into the offensive end, you know, he's not going to hurt you with outside shots or anything. He'll hurt you with some penetration. You got to contain him there. But I do think that if they pressure him, I think he's going to get tired and he's going to need some rest. And when he's not on the court, they're not near the team they are when he is on the court. So I think that's something that Baylor could do and could prove to be very beneficial to him. But I do think Baylor's going to win it. And I think they're going to be playing for a national championship. Turning to the other bracket, UCLA and the UCLA-Michigan game. I'll be honest with you. I watched the first 4 or 5 minutes and I had recorded the game. So I was, I hate commercials. I'd hate that the NCAA has gone to this 4 minute deal. Every 4 minutes you have a 3 or 4 minute commercial. I talk about it in my book saying, you know, how can these guys be tired at the end of the game when they get four breaks of 3 or 4 minutes in each half And then the coaches have their timeouts in between and everything. Hell, you're on the bench as much as you're on the court. So I don't like that, but I record the game so that I can, I don't have to watch the commercials. And in recording this one, I started skipping after about 4 or 5 minutes in. It looked like Michigan was just going to blow UCLA out. Didn't look like UCLA belonged on the same court. Well, I skipped up to almost halftime and I looked and I said, what happened? UCLA, excuse me, UCLA is ahead at halftime. Are you kidding me? How'd that happen? And then I was listening to some of the people talking at halftime. They said that Juzang went off for 18 points in the first half. I said, oh, he must have really got hot. And he did. And he ended up scoring 28 of their 51 points, which is pretty amazing. But that game, there were a couple things in there that I was surprised at. Number one, I was surprised that after somebody scores 18 on your first half and they don't have much else offense, I don't think, other than him and the point guard, there was no double teaming. You know, why didn't you double team, get the ball out of his hands? And what surprised me about that is that Coach Howard had played in the NBA, had coached in the NBA. That's what they do all the time. You know, every team has somebody that's a star stud. And the way they minimize them is by getting the ball out of their hands. Most of the time, that is every time they catch or they get into a certain position, there's an automatic double team. Now, maybe that was going to be too difficult for Michigan to change their defense to do something like that. Because you didn't have that much time to practice and you probably didn't anticipate that Juzang was going to be as effective as he was. So UCLA, I think where they're going to really struggle on the offensive end is I do think Gonzaga with this, you know, 4 or 5 days of being able to practice and plan, I think they're going to be able to minimize the effectiveness of Juzang. But one thing they're going to have to do is Campbell's the point guard, and he's good. He's little, but he's really good, and he's quick, and he's smart. And I think you got to stop his penetration. So when UCLA plays Gonzaga, Suggs is going to have to stay in front of him, you know. Suggs is long enough, athletic enough that if Campbell does try and pull up and shoot a shot from three or whatever, he's going to have a hand in his face. And it's, you know, having somebody on you as 6'4" and as long is a lot different than having somebody like the Michigan guard on you who's 5'11", just like you are. And anytime that I played, and I played the point guard position, it was always more difficult if the guy that I was being guarded by was long and, you know, had some size on me. Now, if he wasn't quick, I could get by him. That wasn't a problem. But Suggs is pretty quick and he's so athletic. And I think he's going to be able to stop that penetration. So now, if you can't get by him, you're going to have to take outside shots. And it's just a lot more difficult if you're shooting over somebody 6'4" with long arms and they're athletic. So I think that's something that that I'm going to watch in the Gonzaga-UCLA game. The other thing about the UCLA-Michigan game that I thought was a little bit odd was down towards the end, if you remember, there was two guys who took two shots that surprised me. The first was UCLA had called timeout and they were up one, and Coach Cronin set up a play. They had to shoot before the shot clock went off, and there was still like a 6 or 7 second difference between the shot clock and the game clock, and that's all that was left in the game. So Coach Cronin set up a play, and he went to the corner to shoot a three. Now, you're up one. You hit that shot. Yeah, you'll probably win. I mean, you're four up with 10, 12 seconds to go, you're probably going to win that game. You miss that shot. One basket beat you, and they missed. And it was to their credit that they didn't give up a basket down at the other end. They got the ball back and came back and I think Juzang got fouled, hit one out of two. Then Michigan does almost the same thing. They need two to tie. Now, if I'm playing in that game and I'm Michigan, I'm okay going to overtime. I think I'm going to win that one in overtime. I think we're bigger, stronger. I think we can beat them. But Coach Howard, again, chose to go for a three. And the kid missed the three. And it was our point guard. He was coming down. He had a chance. He was on the left side of the lane and left side of the court. And he had a chance to kind of head fake the guy and be able to go around him. And he had pretty much clear path to the basket, I think. And if not, he had just a nice little pull up, kiss off the glass jumper, could have tied it. He chose not to, and he shot the three. Now, it looked like that was the plan, and maybe it wasn't, you know, because if you've been a coach, kids don't do what you tell them to do quite often, you know, and it's a game of read and react anyway. So the kid made the decision to take the three, and he missed it. Well, to Michigan's benefit, they got that ball back for a half second. And again, the shot that they set up was a fadeaway three. And you're going, why would you not run something? I mean, Bill Self would not have done that, KU's coach. I mean, Bill Self has some great inbounds plays. His kids execute extremely well. He'd have gotten a two, or at least he got a great opportunity for a two, and it probably would have been a lob for a dunk. But those are things that I know you practice, and you come down to the end of the game. Michigan, in this case, decided to go for three, lost the game, didn't get to overtime. So that was kind of a surprise to me. But the UCLA Gonzaga game, personally, I don't think it's going to be close. Just watching Gonzaga, you know, Gonzaga put on a clinic offensively and defensively, a clinic in their Elite Eight game. USC, they would have had to play an absolutely perfect plus game in order to beat Gonzaga that night. And if you really think about it, Kispert, their All-American, didn't have a very good game. He got 18 points, but didn't shoot the ball very well. He had some wide open threes that boy's just not going to miss. And he did. And defensively, he was almost a liability at times. They were able to go over him quite often. Now, I don't know. I haven't seen them enough to know if he just had an off game, both offensively and defensively, or if he is maybe their weakest of the five defenders. But I wonder, you know, can you expose them a little bit on that? Although they are just so good at help defense. They know when to come trap, when not to, when to bluff. Great hands, and they rebound pretty well. So in this game, I think that UCLA is going to wear down. They don't have the bench strength that Gonzaga does. I just think that they're going to wear down some trying to guard. I mean, if you're chasing somebody around the court on offense all the time, and that their offense is awesome. If you'll notice, watch them. They don't dribble the ball unless they're going somewhere. You know, when they catch, that ball's out of their hands very quickly to the next guy, and they're on the move. They don't catch and watch. They catch and cut. And people are cutting with and without the ball. If they do catch and dribble, they're going to the basket. And they're all such absolutely great passers. I mean, it isn't just Suggs. Suggs is a really good passer. But Nembhard, he threw a couple dimes to people. I mean, you go, wow. He had one. He was driving one time and hit threw a pass to the corner. And it was perfect. And I can't remember who was over that. I think it was Ayaya. I think that's his name. I may have mispronounced it. But in the corner for wide open three, might have been Kispert. And it was just a great pass. And Ayaya is a really nice passer too. And the thing that impresses me about Gonzaga is, you know, they all know their roles, but from game to game, their roles may change. You know, I've seen games early in the year where Ayayo just went off, and then he got the ball in right in the right position, and you couldn't stop him. He was in the 20s, just really, really effective. Well, the game the other night, he didn't take very many shots. You know, he could have. He had some open looks that he didn't take, but the reason he didn't take them is because he saw somebody else that had a great shot, either a layup or a wide open three or whatever, and he got the ball to him. Now, in watching that game against USC, I only saw two mistakes that I can think of without watching the film, and they were both in transition. Now, the one thing that I think the one area that they made a mistake in was there's a transition in the first half with Timmy. He got a steal, and he took it off the dribble himself. It was the first time that he got the steal. He picked the guy, picked their point guard. You know, here's your 6'10 center picking the point guard. Wow, it's pretty impressive. Then he picks it up and goes off the dribble. Well, he went into a lot of traffic, and he should have, as he was coming down court, he should have gotten the ball to a guard or to a ball handler and just went to the rim and let the ball handler get the ball to him inside. Instead, he tried to take it himself and in traffic. He may have gotten fouled, hit one or two free throws or something, but that was, in my opinion, that was not a good decision on his part. Now, a few plays later, he makes another steal, goes the length of the court dribbling on a one-on-one type thing and made a really nice move at the end and scored. So he's capable, but when he's going one-on-three, which he did that first time, not a good decision. The second one was also in transition where Ayayo was coming down and Nembhard was in front of him. And he threw a pass across the lane, or almost across the lane. Nembhard gets it and he goes in and he goes up for a left-handed layup, got fouled and hit one of two free throws. We didn't teach that. If you're ahead like that on a 2-on-1 and you take it in and the guy comes to you, you dump it down behind you and your teammate comes and gets a layup or a dunk. And that's something that I think he could have done. Other than that, I didn't see hardly anything that they did that you could even think about criticizing. And it kind of was a sidebar. We had a drill when I was coaching that we used quite often, probably every other day, if not almost every day. And it was a 3-on-2, 2-on-1 drill. And if you're interested in it, you can go to my website. It's www.drjoebrickner.com. And I've got an area that you can sign up and subscribe. If you subscribe, I'll send you this drill. Let me explain it to you real quickly. The 3-on-2 you set up with, you have the three lines down at one end like normal. And down at the other end, instead of setting two guys already planted, basically one at the free throw line and the other down into the paint, have them on the sidelines. And so when you blow the whistle and the 3-on-2 starts, the two guys on the sidelines have to run and touch the middle of the court. And then they come over and now they can get into their defensive positions. But it kind of simulates what could happen in a game instead of two guys just sitting down there waiting for you to come down. So if you run across and then the two guys get into their defensive positions, and I'd usually have them somewhere around the top of the key is where they'd be on the sideline, one on one side, one on the other, come touch the top of the key and then pop back into their defense. As a 3-on-2 comes down, we always had our guy in the middle bringing the ball up, stop at the free throw line. And in today's game, I know this probably goes back to their AAU training. They don't stop there anymore. They take it all the way to the glass, no matter if there's a 7-foot guy down there or not. They take it all the way to the glass. And more often than not, watching college basketball, you watch, they miss. You know, either get their shot blocked or they'll miss a shot. Sometimes they're lucky and they have a teammate tip it in. Most of the time they don't, and it's just a wasted opportunity. So we always taught them, stop at the free throw line. That jumper at the free throw line should be just as good as a layup. If you're a guard and you can't pull up and shoot a medium range jump shot from the free throw line straight away, not good, not good. That's a great shot, but you got to practice it. And we did every day. And if they come get you, you can dump to one side and they've either got a layup or they'll kick it right back over across the lane to the other guy on the other side and he'll get a layup. So the 3-on-2, you should score on that practically every time. Now, what we do then is immediately we go 2-on-1. So whoever shot the ball is what we used to say, whoever shot the ball had to become the defender. All right. On the going back the other direction. And we'd have the two guys who were on defense then become the offense. Now, if the ball went in, they had to take the ball out of bounds and push it really hard. If it didn't, they took it right off the rim and took off. And then our defender had to get back and guard them. And that's where we really practiced and we taught. If you're 2-on-1, we can't let one guy guard both of you, right? So if the guy without the basketball is ahead of you, then the man in the middle guarding can guard both of you. It's hard to throw that pass without him being involved unless you loop it up over the top by the rim and you get a dunk. When I was coaching, we didn't have very many players that could do that. So we had to be a lot smarter on our 2-on-1s. What we did is pull the guy out. So if you're on a 2-on-1 break and you don't have the ball, you trail and let the guy with the ball be in front of you going hard. And we taught him, go all the way to the basket on a 2-on-1. Try to score. And if you can, you do. But if you go up and they're guarding you, it's so simple to drop the ball back behind you to the trailing teammate who then is going to be wide open for a layup because the guy who was trying to stop you from scoring is still either up in the air or just coming down and he's not going to have time to recover. So anyway, that's a sidebar. Again, if you want a copy of that drill on how to run it, just go to my website and subscribe and I'll send that to you. Now, don't feel like if you do subscribe to my websites, you're going to get bombarded by things. I send out a notice once a week. That's all I do, one notice a week. And anyway, let me go back to the Gonzaga UCLA game. The Zags, all they need to do is stop two players, contain two players. So I just don't think it's going to be much of a game. I do think that Gonzaga is going to have another 10-plus win. I know they've won every game but one by 10 or more points. And that other one, the other one was 8, I think. So I don't think they're going to have much trouble with UCLA. And Kispert's going to be a lot better. He'll be a lot better. The championship game then I think is going to be Baylor, like everybody else. It's going to be Baylor and Gonzaga. That one's going to be fun to watch, especially if Baylor starts moving on offense, because they can shoot the ball, and they've got a good solid bench who can score and defend, and they go 8 deep. Gonzaga goes 7 deep. I just think it's going to be a terrific basketball game, unless Baylor decides to walk the ball up the court, which they shouldn't. But if Mitchell's not in, you notice Butler walked the ball up the court all the time. When Mitchell's in, they push it. So I think they get to push the ball if they do. And Gonzaga's got to guard them in a transition type environment. I think they're going to get some nice looks and they can shoot. So I think it's going to be really an exciting game. Looking at Gonzaga against Baylor, with all their movement and with somebody as good as Timmy in the middle in his decision making, they're going to be really difficult to stop. So in my opinion, and it's just my opinion, I think that it's going to be a high scoring game. They're both very good defenders, but they're also both very good offensive teams. And I just think with all the weapons that Gonzaga has, they shoot the ball so well. All of them do. And they're so smart. They move without the ball. And every one of them can pass the ball. You can't say that about Baylor. Their three guards are really good at that, but their big guys are not the same skill level as a Timmy or a Kispert. So in my humble opinion, I think Gonzaga wins the national championship. Not sure it's going to be by 10, but I put the championship trophy in their trophy case, and they'll be the first team since Bobby Knight's 76 team to go undefeated. And personally, I hope it happens. I really do. I love seeing people who love to play together, and not that Baylor doesn't, they do. They really do. So either one of them winning would be great. But to see an undefeated team of that caliber, with that camaraderie, doing all the things that you think should be done at the college level, it'd be fun. So that's my spiel on the Final Four. If you have some comments, I'd sure like to see them. I know we all have our own opinions. This is more from a coaching standpoint than a fan. So if you enjoyed this podcast, I hope you join me for others on my in-depth interviews with very successful leaders, coaches, even ministers. And on this podcast here, if you'd share it, I'd appreciate it. Like it, subscribe, it'd be great. And until next time, this is Coach Joe Brickner signing off. Have a great Easter.